Director's report. Director Anderson?
Just as a reminder to the commission and to Mr. Turner, according to the Fish and Wildlife Commission's policy on sturgeon, the activities associated with setting seasons, bag limits, and those kinds of things are delegated to the director in view of the fact that we need to coordinate with Oregon so that we have compatible and consistent regulations. So obviously we have a briefing on sturgeon later today, and there's the whole issue of whether or not the resource is healthy enough to even have a season. I think that's probably the fundamental question. So we'll be having that briefing, a follow-up to the briefing that we had in December here this afternoon, and so we'll be discussing that piece.
Thank you.
Ready for the...
Yeah. We're ready.
Thank you very much. Good morning, everyone. I was talking with Joe a couple mornings ago, and we were thinking about, well, what would be items that we would include in our report this morning, and we're reflecting back on the holiday period and the commission meeting in December, and thinking, well, there's not a lot that's been going on because of the holidays and people being on vacation and so on, so we were thinking we might have a hard time coming up with some items that would be of interest, and now I think I've got a list that maybe is longer than anyone I've had before. So, I think we'll come close to staying within our time limit, and Joe will have some budget update information following my report. I think the first thing I would just want to bring you up to a date on is our fee bill. You may recall that we had done an extensive analysis internally in terms of looking at where our funding gaps were in order to maintain kind of status quo level of activities, everything from hatchery production to enforcement to habitat pieces, as well as wildlife activities. And we had identified a gap of about $6.4 million, and we had then in turn worked with stakeholders to develop a recreational package and a commercial package, and the shortfalls were all within the fish management, fish production part of the activities with the agency, as well as enforcement. And so the package that we put together and that the commission adopted was intended to raise about $6.4 million. You'll recall we had a fee package that included a pretty modest increase in recreational fishing licenses and then a more robust increase in commercial licenses. Can you hear me all right?
We've got a school bus that's revving its engines right outside the door. So, Tammy, can you ask them to move the school bus?
That's in the job description 41B.
Do you want me to continue?
Yeah,
can you hear okay?
Can you hear okay out there? Okay.
So, of course, we put that fee bill together, submitted as part of our legislative package into OFM in September, and then since that time, we've been continuing to refine it, working with stakeholders and so forth. But at the same time, we're also aware... how'd you do with that, Tammy? All right. We also are aware that included in the governor's budget is certain salary increases for some of our employees, cost of living increases for some of our employees, and the financial burden on the agency associated with those increases consume the majority of the revenue that would be raised by a fee increase. So all of the activities that we were hoping to restore and rebuild with respect to the revenue that would come from the fee bill is essentially going to be, if the legislature were to adopt the budget and if it had the increases in salaries and COLAs that are in the governor's budget, then we would fall far short of closing the gap needed for those activities. So just we did some analysis, budget staff did some analysis on that this week. There's some additional analysis to be done, but it just goes to show that this is going to be a very dynamic kind of a session relative to budget, and for us to be able to realize the outcomes that we're hoping for in our package, we're going to have to be working the legislature hard, be light on our feet, so to speak, and be at the same time working with stakeholders, because the package, in order to achieve the outcomes, will likely have to change as we go through the session. I wanted to talk a little bit about the Puget Sound Chinook Harvest Management Plan. This is the plan that leads us to get a permit from NOAA Fisheries under the Endangered Species Act so that we can have incidental takes. It allows our fisheries to take place both in Puget Sound, and it also plays into the ability of to implement the fisheries associated with ocean fisheries that are consummated through the Pacific Council process, because we have Puget Sound stocks that are impacted in our ocean fisheries as well. So, and you also recall, we've had two different multi-year plans that have been approved in the past. At the current time, we don't have a multi-year plan. Last year, we did a one-year plan, and this year we're in the same position where we need to do a one-year plan. And so there were certain activities that were expected of the state and tribes that came from the language that was in our permit last year, and there are two of those activities that are have been of particular concern to us as well as to NOAA Fisheries. One is having to do with the Skokomish River, and the commitment that the co-managers made to try to establish a late timed fall run. And we've also been working with the Skokomish tribe with the intent of trying to establish a spring Chinook run in the Skokomish River and have that population be the primary population instead of currently it's the fall run. But because establishing a spring Chinook run is well down the road in that we don't have one, and we will need to bring broodstock in and do that kind of work to establish one. In the interim period, what we said we would do is that we would try to establish a late-timed run of fall Chinook in the Skokomish. So what we did is about during the time period of 5 to 6 weeks after the peak of the run this year is we took broodstock, and we are prepared to release about 200,000 fish this coming year to begin that process of trying to establish that later run. NOAA is concerned that we were not following through on that commitment, and so there's been a fair amount of activity in the last month or so trying to, and I think in part because they weren't fully knowledgeable of the work that we had done. But so we're working that issue, and that's a key component to us being able to get a new one-year permit following the North of Falcon process in 2015. The other one is the operation of the Nisqually Weir, and there were concerns that the weir was not being operated, or was not being operated properly, that we weren't getting the results, the desired results, in terms of reducing the number of hatchery fish that are interacting with natural origin fish in the natural environment. And so we have been working with the Nisqually Tribe and NOAA Fisheries. We're going to have a workshop. It's tentatively scheduled for February 24th. So we're going to be looking at how it's functioning, what improvements need to be made, so looking at what the gaps are, making sure that wild fish are successfully passing the weir. And then we also want to ascertain what the productivity of those wild fish are that are spawning in the natural environment. So those two pieces we've been devoting a lot of work to in the last month or so, and will in the coming weeks, to put us in a position where those aren't obstacles for NOAA in terms of providing a permit once we reach agreement with the tribes on a 2015 set of agreed to fisheries. So we're gonna go over to Eastern Washington here now for a few minutes, and there were some handouts that were in front of you this morning, and one of those handouts looks like this. It's the Stmelk Quilchuk Community Vision document. And the Stmelk partnership, Bob, you can see on the bottom, is that it's one of the unique situations where we have a really diverse set of interests within, you know, this is outside of the Wenatchee area, that have gotten together, and we have worked closely with them to develop this partnership and this vision and habitat conservation for the betterment of fish and wildlife resources. If you turn to this next page, this is just one of the maps that I pulled out of the document, out of the partnership document. And you can see those five parcels represented there with the squares. And what I'm going to be speaking to is the square on the north end and the square on the east end. And I'll also talk a little bit about the two squares, the one on the west side and the one on the south side. So these four parcels were originally, the intent was to have WDFW take ownership of these four parcels, and they are currently owned by the Department of Natural Resources. And we had some difficulties in securing agreements with Department of Natural Resources on the amount of money that what the appropriate amount of money was for the Department of Fish and Wildlife to pay for those, and as a result, the cost of those properties were higher than we anticipated they would be. And then we, as an interim step, we entered into a 50-year lease on those four parcels with the expectation that we would purchase those properties for a value that we had previously agreed to that then changed. So we did end up buying the parcel on the west side and the south side, but the parcel on the north side and the east side have still been outstanding. Yes, Commissioner Holzmiller?
How many acres are in these parcels? Are they a section? Or?
They're a section.
Okay, thank you.
So you can see that these parcels play a significant role from a water perspective and snow retention, which is what the first map depicts. If you turn to the next one, you can take a look and see the value of those parcels in terms of summer habitat for elk. And then the third map, it's looking at the best of the best for wildlife resources overall, and you can see the importance those parcels play. We have been working Senator Parlett has been extremely, it's right in her backyard, and has been extremely active and interested in seeing this issue resolved. That the issue being that north parcel and the eastern parcel get transferred into WDFW ownership. There was a time about a year ago when Department of Natural Resources had been entertaining the potential of leasing some portion of those sections for agricultural use, particularly orchards, and that caused some concern amongst the partnership if that were to occur. So we have been working to try to resolve that issue. It's one of the things that I had on my list that I wanted to try to get resolved before my tenure was over. And we are close to having an agreement, I think essentially we do, with Department of Natural Resources that has two pieces. One, we would do a 20-year lease for those two pieces, and we would also have a purchase plan that would have the department purchase those properties over and pay the value of those properties over a 5-year period, and that the Department of Natural Resources and the Department of Fish and Wildlife would together go work with the legislature to get the appropriations needed to buy and secure those properties over a 5-year term, so we're not trying to go in and get the lump sum in one session. So we haven't got ink on the paper yet under the signature lines, but we're very close, and I'm hoping to have that completed here before the end of the month. Let's
see. Commissioner Schmitten?
Yeah. Director, you might mention, too, that this doesn't remove anything from the tax rolls. Already they're owned by the state. It's just shifting the ownership from DNR to
Good point.
So the county is very favorable. In fact, the county entered into their own purchase of four sections or so.
Okay. The next topic I wanted to cover was the matter associated with the federal budget and Mitchell Act production. We've brought this to your attention here almost every commission meeting for the last 6 months, and I have some numbers that I wanted to share with you to put into context the kinds of reductions that are being implemented by the Department of Fish and Wildlife here in Washington as well as Oregon this year, and what the potential additional reductions will be for 2015. In December of in 14, the Congress passed and the President signed into law the 2015 federal budget. As expected, most of the federal funds that are significant to the department remained at 2014 levels. And while that's mostly good news, it will carry forward an $800,000 reduction in monies used for production and Mitchell Act facilities by our agency, and it will have a similar impact on Oregon. So for 2014, the reductions that are being implemented, have been implemented, is we had a reduction in coho production of about 600,000, and these are all in facilities below Bonneville, which represents about 7% of the coho production But as a reminder, we've already had reductions, previous reductions, so it's 7% of a lower number than we had 2 to 3 bienniums ago. We also reduced steelhead production by 24,000, and that represents 2% of the steelhead production in the Columbia. Over in Oregon, they reduced spring Chinook production by 250,000, which was about 2% of the spring Chinook production, and they reduced coho by 500,000.
Where are those spring Chinook planted?
In the lower river.
In the safe areas?
I don't want to say that with absolute certainty.
That was an important piece of our
exactly, but the additional spring production is an important piece. Looking forward into 2015, and while we don't have the final apportionment from NOAA yet, with the coming out of that salmon management line item, both Pacific Salmon Commission and Mitchell Act facilities are in that line item. The apportionments haven't been made, but if the apportionments are made similar to what they were last year, we'd have to have some additional reductions in production on our side of about 4.1 million Chinook, which is about 32% of our production, coho at 250,000, spring Chinook at 500,000, and winter steelhead at 40,000. So there are some significant cuts on the horizon again, depending on the apportionment that NOAA does. Over on the Oregon side, they're looking at reductions up to 500,000 in Chinook and another 500,000 in coho. So these are going to start compounding, and they're going to start really, I think, having an impact in fisheries if we're not able to get those funding reductions backfilled. And it's also a reason that our fee package, which in part is designed to use some of that revenue to backfill this loss, is really important. So we have that strategy of there's about 4.8 million that would be raised out of our recreational fee increase the way it's currently designed, and about 1.6 million on the commercial side, and we are intending to use a portion of that revenue to backfill these losses. So it makes that fee bill all that much more important. I also just wanted to spend a couple of minutes on cougar management, because it is a fairly significant management issue that we've dealt with in the past. We've divided our state up into 49 different cougar hunt areas. We assign a harvest guideline to each one of those areas that corresponds to a 12 to 16% harvest rate. We have our general early season that goes from September 1 through the end of December, and then we look at the general season in January, February, and March, and beginning January 1, we look at what the mortalities have been by region, measure those against the guideline that comes from applying the 12 to 16% harvest rate, and make decisions as to whether the seasons January, February, March will be allowed to proceed. We have recently closed some of those areas. We've closed 8 of the 49 areas as a result of those areas meeting their harvest guidelines. And so we're continuing to monitor the mortalities of cougars in each one of those management areas, and there may be additional closures as we work through the next several months. But I wanted you to be aware in case you heard from constituents about closures. That's the rationale. That's how we're implementing our plan in terms of those closures. The next topic I just wanted to touch on was we've had, really all of our programs, enforcement, wildlife, habitat, enforcement, wildlife, habitat, and fish have been, as they always do, having some really good internal planning sessions, looking at their business plan, making sure they're prioritizing their activities. And one that was recently held was the enforcement command staff, which is, of course, the chief and deputy chiefs, the lieutenants, the captains, and the sergeants came together and held a two-day meeting with those folks to discuss their approach to protecting the public safety and natural resources for 2015. They've implemented a results-oriented system that clearly illustrates the connection with the agency's goals through our strategic framework and the nine objectives that are captured under each one of our goals. They're in the process of developing a comprehensive business plan for the 15-17 biennium, and those are going to be linked to initiatives intended to improve their business practices, maintain order and safety in the outdoors, protect seafood customers and the legitimate trade, reduce illegal take and trafficking of fish and wildlife, protect habitats, and better connect with the public. So I had a chance to talk with Chief Crown just yesterday, and I knew they were doing that this activity this week, and it sounded like a really good session, and just wanted you to be aware of it. The other handout, there's two more handouts that you have, but the other one is the Nanum Ridge to Columbia River Recreation and Access Plan. It looks like this. And this has been, I just pulled out a few pages out of the plan. This has, if you turn the page there under the acknowledgments, this has been a really intensive process to look at a specific geographic area that encompasses ownerships from both the Department of Natural Resources and the Department of Fish and Wildlife. And I'll show you where the project area is. But I'm really proud of the partnership that we have with DNR and how we moved through this together, and our staff at the staff level within the regions worked really well. There was lots of controversial issues associated with access in this particular area. There's a letter that's the third page that Commissioner Goldmark and I sent out to constituents. The next page has the title Project Overview, where the Department of Natural Resources goals are laid out. And then on the back page of that, you'll see where the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife's goals are laid out. And then you'll get to the first map that depicts where the recreational planning area is in the yellow. And the next map starts to look, well, both of the first map looks at, also has the DNR regions and project locations from a statewide perspective, so you can see that. And then the next map does the same thing with the Department of Fish and Wildlife. And then finally, the last page is the map of the project area. And of course, we've talked a lot about Clackam Elk. We've talked a lot about the interactions between vehicles and winter range. And so, and we've talked a lot about trying to maintain public access to public lands, but at the same time make sure that we're managing those lands in a way that benefits fish and wildlife resources. So this is the project area. And so, and we had a very active constituent group that helped work through all of the issues. And so we've just completed this. It's a big piece of work. It's a couple years in the making. And so Commissioner Goldmark and I just signed off on the certification of the plan, so wanted you to be aware of that. Just real quick on our North of Falcon team, you know, we've been doing some succession planning for our North of Falcon team, making sure that we have a strong team to continue the work in that field. And as part of that, we've been working with Pat Patillo, and we're looking at bringing him on board for a three-month period. We're doing it through a sole source contract that we're working through the process, but we've got all the documents written up, and we're moving through that process. Plan to have Pat on board by the 1st of February, and had a chance to meet with him day before yesterday, and he, along with Jim Scott and Ron Warren, and others have been working to nail that scope of work down. So good progress there. Just a couple more items. One of them is you're certainly aware of the issues that we've had associated with tribal hunting, the geographic scope where the treaty right extends from a geographic perspective, and we're working issues that include Port Gamble, Jamestown, Lower Elwha, Quileute, Macaw. Our historical research associates report has just been finalized. We'll be meeting. We're planning to meet with those tribes on the 20th of January. And in advance of that, I'll be sending letters to each one of those tribes, as well as any other affected tribe, which would be Skokomish, Quinault, and Ho tribes, with the conclusions of the historical research associates, and it's primarily Gail Thompson. So if you're interested in getting one of those, we'll be happy to make it available to you. So. But along those lines, we also have been trying to get to a point where we have agreement with the Upper Skagit tribe, and the Upper Skagit tribe has been asserting that their traditional hunting area extends into eastern Washington. And despite our best efforts, we have been unable to reach agreement on the geographic scope of their traditional hunting right area. And so they have filed a lawsuit against us. It's Skyler v. Anderson. It's filed in Thurston County Court, so it's in a state court. It asks for three things. It asks to clarify the standards that are articulated in the Buchanan decision, the state Supreme Court Buchanan decision, in terms of occupy over an extended period of time as being one of the thresholds to establish a traditional area. So clarify the standards. Then the third or second ask is to declare that the Upper Skagit tribe's traditional area extends into these GMUs on the east side of the Cascades. And then third, it asks the court to enjoin the Department of Fish and Wildlife from enforcing state hunting regulations against members of the Upper Skagit tribe that are hunting consistent with their regulations within this geographic area that they're asserting as part of their traditional area. So, and if there is such a thing as a friendly lawsuit, it's we approached it in that way, really, because we were unable to reach agreement, thought the appropriate third party would be the state court to clarify what exactly is meant in the state Supreme Court's decision associated with the Buchanan case. So that should be interesting, and I suspect we'll get some other tribes that that join in, and it may, depending on what the geographic scope is and whether those include going into other tribes' ceded area, and if they're not part of the lawsuit, do we get to a similar point where we did with Skokomish, that the case doesn't include all of the appropriate parties, so we'll see how that goes. And then next to the last is a couple of things from public affairs and community outreach. We had this great working relationship developed with the Bass Pro Shops and the opening of their new store in South Tacoma. And they invited us to participate in that event and helped promote our role in conservation and outdoor recreation. And in recognition of those efforts, they've donated a portion of the store's opening day proceeds to the department. And so we received a check from them for $28,319 that we will be applying to the Youth Outdoors Initiative. And I've got a copy of the thank you letter that I sent them here that I can hand around and take a look at. But it's so it's, and I don't want to just look at this as a one, you know, this is the start of a really good partnership. We have similar, we've had similar partnerships with Cabela's, but Bass Pro Shops reached out to us and asked us to be a part of their grand opening and provided this donation to us for Youth Outdoor Initiative. So it's pretty cool.
That's fabulous. Commissioner Smith?
Yeah, that's really good news, Phil. Is there a follow-up strategy that's being put together that, you know, could engage some of us and working with them as well and talking? Or
Why don't I talk to you about that and see what we might do there? I mean, I haven't had to the best of my knowledge, unless that's been going on with the public affairs folks and Joe about looking at that strategy to involve you folks, if I want to make sure I understand what that
sure
means.
I mean, I just see the dovetailing into the broad youth initiative,
right?
And I'd like to, you know, keep this snowball growing.
Sure. The other piece is we've as part of our conservation initiative, we've looked at developing a pilot program that would partner with local rural communities to look and see if there are ways for us to increase fish and wildlife activities and the associated economic benefits that are derived from that to the local economies. And so we've chosen a couple of places, and this handout that I gave you is one that where we're doing with the city of Pateras over in Okanagan County and Brewster, and it's we sent a team over there and met with some of the local officials, and then they sponsored an event that was really well attended, and we're pretty excited about the partnership that we've developed with those two communities. Obviously hard hit. One of the reasons we selected that is they were hard hit by the fires, looking for ways that we might be able to help them recover from that using some of the activities that we do. So, again, a really great bunch of work by some folks, both within the region as well as headquarters that have been, and Joe's been a big part of that. And then the last piece is one that I always do, which is a wolf management update. I reported to you last time that we're in the process of doing our winter surveys. That's still going on. We expect to have that information compiled probably toward the end of February, first part of March. We'd be sharing that information with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service as well as Obviously, the commission, our Wolf Advisory Group, and when we get the data finalized, get it up on our website. Our good old Ruby Creek female is still at large. Plans are to look at using a helicopter following the next big snowstorm to see if we can have her join us here and move her over to Western Washington. And people that think it's easy to go out and trap wolves, think again. Fair amount of activity down in Commissioner Holzmiller's part of the world. Last month we've got these wolves that have been, some of that have been collared and identified in Oregon that have taken up residence or spending more time in Washington. And we had this OR-14, which is an older male from their Umatilla pack, has moved into the Blue Mountains. This animal was the alpha male from the pack, and he may have lost his position within the pack or have been injured. We're not sure, talking to ODF&W, and so some of those hypotheses are coming from their folks. It's been confirmed to be traveling alone by multiple staff. The animal is currently located southeast of Dayton. It's being monitored by local district staff. Of course, we're getting the caller data from ODF&W. It appears that the animal's movement have been more localized and in shorter distance than typically seen, which by dispersing animals, possibly supporting that hypothesis that the animal might be injured. And then there's OR-15, is a black male that came out of the Oregon Snake River pack, and he's been residing in Washington in the Blue Mountains in the past 2 or 3 months. Both ODF&W and DFW staff have confirmed multiple times that the animal is traveling with a smaller gray-colored animal. The last 2 months' activity indicate that the territory is being established between Asotin, Columbia, Garfield counties, and probably these two animals are going to get named relative to a pack name when we bring forward our 2014 survey data. We've also got multiple reports here in the last couple of weeks, two in Washington, one in Oregon, of a black and gray wolf that are being observed along the Grand Ronde in GMU 172. The color combination is the same as that combination with the OR-15 pair, but the collar data from OR-15 does not suggest that they're the same animals. So looks like we have two others. And so that there's more and more wolves showing up in Commissioner Holzmiller's part of the world. I reported last time about the new pilot program with Northeast livestock producers in terms of developing a deterrence plan, and that one of the components that makes a difference from some of the approaches that we've used in the past is a collaborative process with a team of local producers that brainstorm with our conflict specialists to identify appropriate non-lethal measures that are expected to be effective. So that's continued, and we're since the last commission, the Smack Out Aladdin Working Group has been formed, and participation has been agreed by almost all the livestock operators operating on private land in the relevant Forest Service in that area. So good progress there. We're also looking at forming one to deal with the Profanity Peak pack, and so we're looking at developing a working group, and that's underway. In terms of depredations, I reported last time that we had that one on December 5th that resulted in a final determination of a probable wolf kill of a sheep in Whitman County. There, you know, that particular instance where he had fencing, and but they'd had a snow event and might have rendered the electric fence inoperable for a day or two, and so some of the animals got out. Fox lights were deployed and continue to be used there. But then on December 16th, so since we met, we responded to a second wolf depredation at the same ranch involving three animals. They were confirmed as wolf depredations. One was confirmed as a wolf depredation, and the other two were unknown. They were pretty well consumed. There wasn't enough left to make a positive determination. Those mortalities occurred about a mile or half a mile outside this fenced area, and again, the fence had suffered some damage to a snow event. It's been some of the fence posts had fallen down. They've come back, repaired them, put heavier posts in. They're using fox lights there as well. And then since we met, that livestock operator has entered into a prevention cooperative agreement with us. So we're working well with them. And then the only other couple things were we went out and are for solicitations for membership to the Wolf Advisory Group, and we got, I think we got 50, I think, applicants, and we're in the final day or decision process of selecting the members, and so I'm expecting to get letters out to people that were selected next week. And we did enlarge the group a little bit. It was 9. I think we're looking at 12. And we've done a real careful look at the balance of membership from in terms of perspectives that people would bring to the table. So we're about ready to bring that process to a close. And then the... we've also developed a contract with a human wildlife conflict collaborator to help evaluate the department's efforts on collaboration with individuals involved in wolf management, public understanding of the implementation of the Wolf Conservation Management Plan, and to assess the function effectiveness of the Wolf Advisor Group. So the assessment process began this month with independent surveys of stakeholders, members of the Wolf Advisor Group, other internal and external parties. We're hopeful that will give us some insights and perhaps identify some new strategies that we can use to help improve our effectiveness in managing wolves on our landscape and interactions with livestock operators, as well as recovery efforts.
Her name, Francine McFadden?
Francine Madden.
Madden.
Yeah.
She's been contacting commissioners. Has everyone been contacted? Just three of us. Okay.
And I said that was the last one. I lied. Hatchery genetic management plans, our whole work in terms of we've got they're submitted, the review process is what we've really been focusing on, and developing our list and prioritizing those associated with the potential litigation risk that they represent absent an approved HGMP, and the other screen is the relative importance of the hatchery production to our fisheries. And then we would look and prioritize those, put them in groups or batches so that we'd be moving through multiple hatchery genetic management plans in batches or through the approval process with an eye on ensuring that we get those. We're not going to get them all done within our 2.5-year window that's associated with that component of the settlement with the Wild Fish Conservancy lawsuit, but we want to get the ones that are those high-priority ones, so the majority of them, but probably not all of them, will get done under that time frame. The problem is the lack of capacity within NOAA to do the review, and so we've got a lot of people engaged, the recreational community, Tim Thompson, the tribes in particular. I had a follow-up meeting with Lummi, Upper Skagit, Puyallup, and we've had follow-up meetings with NOAA to see what we can do to build, to add capacity for the review process so that we can get these done within that window. And of course, then we have the other window we have is those five hatcheries that are producing steelhead that, absent having approved HGMPs, we wouldn't be releasing fish from in May of 2015. So those are obviously near the top of our priority list and ones that are being worked on.
Commissioner Carpenter?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I just thought I should have done it earlier, to bring to the attention of my colleagues that I was asked to attend a meeting on Wednesday in downtown Seattle with Congressman Norm Dix and Tim Thompson and some representatives from recreational leadership and two tribes, the Lummi and Upper Skagit. And I thought it was quite a good meeting. It has to do with HGMPs and potential agreement with the HSRG group, and there seems to be a fair amount of energy and momentum there, and I'll stay the course on it and sit in on the meetings and see if it could be of some help to everyone.
So I'll turn it over to Joe.
Good morning, Madam Chair. Good morning, Commissioners, public, and staff. I guess I'd like to think of my part of this presentation as being the probably more exciting and fun part of the Director's Office report, because I'm going to talk about budget and revenue and a little bit about the Discover Pass. I'm going to be working off of four documents, and public members, if you'd like to see these, they're on the back table. First, I'd like to start off with the governor's budget. I think you know that the governor's budget represents the first of four budgets that we'll be dealing with over this challenging session that's coming up. He issued his budget, and this is traditional, after the December forecast, and the House and Senate will wait until the February forecast, so we'll see a House and Senate budget probably around the end of February or early March. And then the negotiations begin. The legislature switches from policy discussions typically to budget discussions to try to bring a budget home by the end of the session, which is in mid-April, if they complete it on time. And so those are the four budgets we'll be looking at and evaluating as they roll out. Governor's budget this time, there were actually two budgets that came out. And you may hear the term, and I will describe for the department, the outcome of a book one budget. That's a budget that balances with no new revenues. That's constitutionally required. And that really didn't get a lot of play. And what got more attention, and what I'll highlight here, is the book two budget. Book two does include an assumption that new revenues are available, through a variety of sources. So just keep that in mind as I go through book two. There's a very controversial discussion that's just starting about, do we have new revenues? Do we need new revenues? If so, where do they come from? And it's not clear, how or where the legislature will end up. This is one of the more difficult to predict sessions, I think, that we're entering into. So looking at this document titled The Governor's, and we say new law because that focuses on a book two. It means, new revenue, the governor's budget proposal as it relates to the agency. And then there's another document that I put in your stack that has a lot of detail, the recommendation summary. I'll touch on that briefly. In the governor's budget, going back to the text piece here, we do go in and try to address unanticipated or new costs for the current biennium. So you'll see the title 2015 Supplemental Operating Budget. And with those requests, we received really all that we had asked for, except increases to attorney general legal costs. So we're left, unless the House and Senate plans to fix that, which they probably won't, with about a $370,000 problem related to some existing cases or some expert witnesses we anticipate having to hire between now and the end of the biennium. And we're working our way through that. We did receive funding for 13 items totaling $9.8 million, 8 of which was federal authority linked to increased federal contracts or Pittman-Robertson increases. So fairly successful there, a problem that I think is manageable with AG costs, et cetera. But that was good news. And then moving into the governor's budget for next biennium, 2015 to 2017, the budget split into two pieces, maintenance-level funding, which is intended to cover those activities that we are committed to already, the law, the legislature. Somehow we have to do these things, and there have been cost increases. And the second part is the performance-level piece of the biennial operating budget. And those include activities that are new proposals, et cetera. So let me run you through the highlights there. On the maintenance level, we got everything we asked for, basically, except for one significant exception where the governor chose to roll back PILT payments again to the 2009 level. So we had gone in asking for the expected increases related to open space designation by counties, and the governor chose to keep it at the 2009 level, which the legislature has done the last several years. On the performance level,
Commissioner sure. Holtzmiller?
On that one, and correct me if I'm wrong, but lands acquired after 2009 has not hit the tax rolls yet. Is that correct?
This would have any lands that we have acquired since 2009 or through the next biennium. We wouldn't acknowledge the open space designation. We would pay a 2009 rate schedule.
Okay.
I can talk to you more, Commissioner.
Yeah, it gets down in the weeds pretty deep on that. Thank you.
So looking at next biennium's performance level request, we received $19.4 million and over all types of funds. $7 million of that, and you heard from the director that this is evolving, but $7 million of that was tied to our fee legislation proposal, which would support salmon production, hatchery maintenance, enforcement, fisheries management activities throughout the state. So a big chunk of that 19.4 was tied to our fee bill, which is likely to change some. We received $1.5 million from the ELSA account, the Environmental Legacy Stewardship account, which is related to the state toxics, for Puget Sound fish health. And this is closely related to the Puget Sound agenda, where we would implement monitoring of fish contaminants throughout the Puget Sound, collect samples. This additional investment would allow us to assess conditions of persistent environmental chemicals in bottom fish and juvenile salmon to determine what is working to reduce toxicity in fish species. About $800,000 for our recovery of Puget Sound steelhead. This would allow us to continue the study about high mortality of steelhead smolts as they enter the sound. And we've nearly doubled our funding for aquatic invasive species. The $800,000 that came out of the Aquatic Lands Enhancement Account would allow us to move forward and sort of bridge the discussion between the fairly minimal funding we have now to a more permanent, sustained fund source around management of aquatic invasives. We got $250,000 for managing elk hoof disease. This will allow us to hire a person to manage that process more effectively, and some process costs too, so we can be more aggressive and more organized about dealing with elk hoof disease. The second part of the budget has to do with
before you go on to that, in relation to the first one under performance level, the discussing what the $7 million will be used for, under B, support salmon production, et cetera, et cetera. My understanding is one of the key assurances that we're giving the sport fishers is that we will also look for new opportunities to expand recreational fishing. So I think when you're describing what we're doing with this money, that needs to be a key piece of it.
That's certainly a big part of the discussion, Madam Chair. And this initial list was part of the assessment we did that we brought into the discussion, but that's certainly a part of the thinking. So as you remember, the governor asked all agencies to look at what a 15% general fund state reduction might entail in terms of cuts, and that amounted to nearly $11 million for Fish and Wildlife. The governor's budget took about $2 million of that $11 million. We don't see any reductions in staffing levels, which is good news. And it didn't include any of the hatchery closure options that we put forward. However, it did look at production reductions in the George Adam hatchery, where 56% of our fall Chinook production would be lost, and at Hood's Port, which would affect chum, fall Chinook, and pink salmon production.
Madam Chair. Commissioner Kehoe.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. I've already spoken to Joe about the Hood's Port hatchery, the elimination of fall chum production. This was very distressing to me when I saw this. All the other hatchery programs were funded except for this one. And then, of course, George Adams as well. Hood Canal is a very, very productive commercial fishery for both the non-treaty and treaty commercial fishers. 5 years ago, PSVOA and the department entered into a public-private partnership to operate another hatchery in the Hood Canal area, McKernan Hatchery, which accounts for 40% of the hatchery production. The balance, 60%, is at Hood's Port. And it's kind of mind-boggling to me. I mean, I think it sends a very bad message. Let me just say too that the 60% reduction with a closure of Hood's Port fall production, chum production, will have a profound effect on the fishery. Not only in Hood Canal, but I mean these fisheries are connected also into the South Sound chum fishery. And so I just wanted to reiterate, I think this is a very bad message and precedent to send to other organizations that are willing to step up and to help out the department, only to be undercut with this decision. I'm not quite sure the logic. I know the commercial fishers will work hard to restore the funding for this, but I was very distressed to see this, and don't really quite understand the logic. But with that, I just wanted the commission to appreciate that. So, thank you.
Well said, Commissioner Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to speak to this for a second too, because I'm very sympathetic to Commissioner Kehoe's position. And I think in the future, if we have further budget constraints that we have to work with these public-private partnerships, whether they're recreational hatchery concerns or commercial hatchery concerns, I think are a valid way to do business. So I also want to state that I'm concerned about that. The other part that the George Adams fall Chinook 56% reduction is no small eye poke either. And I don't know what kind of fallback position we can create or come up with to try and reinstate that. But that's a big loss of production.
Deputy Director Storr, You know, some of us are new commissioners, so I think it's a good idea to explain what our approach should be if we disagree, but and that you know, give us a sense of kind of some sideboards here. We don't want to get the department into trouble, but we may personally disagree with some of the choices of the governor. We don't believe that you can disagree with the governor, or there might be some limitations on how you do that. So just help some of the new commissioners understand.
Well, remember, when the governor asked us to put forward suggestions, and with general fund limited to the five areas that it is within our activity, you know, array as in terms of the things we produce, the products that we serve up, we have a lot of ugly choices. And so as we looked at a share of those reductions that would be related to our fisheries management, our fisheries production, of our 83 hatcheries, I think it's the number 16 that have general fund associated with them. And so right away you start to zero in on some share of that pain coming from a very limited number of hatcheries. And as we look then further at our tribal commitments, who pays for what, where do the rec the sports license fees go versus the commercial license fees, a variety of factors, we have over the last 4 or 5 years ended up in reductions in these facilities. And I think Commissioner Kehoe's points are, I mean, I hear them. I understand the concern. We share the concern in a lot of ways. So what the governor does is picks up our recommendations and the rationale and either accepts it or doesn't. I think the commission, we continue to try to come to you early and often as we develop these. So there's a time where, you know, we can have those detailed conversations about, is this the right focus? Is this the right place? I think once the governor puts it out there, there's not a lot you can do to change that, but you have the legislative process, the House and the Senate budgets, that'll you know, provide ample time and opportunity, I think, for more of that discussion. And you know, we'd love to hear other ideas about if not here, where, because we got to take it somewhere. And you know, and it's just because we put these forward doesn't mean we think they're great ideas. So,
okay. Commissioner Monken.
Can we get a rundown from those two hatcheries as to how much is supported by various entities like the state and the tribes so that we can see what the total overall cuts are going to be in those hatcheries?
We could do that, Commissioner.
And wherever there are any private sector support or nonprofits involvement, I'd like to see that.
We can lay that out for you. I don't believe there is, but...
Well, in the past, there's been contribution from private nonprofits for chum salmon, streamside incubation facilities. Are those still up and operating, Phil? Do you know?
Well, the partnership we have with Per Se and Decimal Owners Association is at McKernan.
Yeah.
You know, whether there's egg boxes or something, I'm not sure that the Skokomish George Adams, I'll pull it up here. I can look. But the, I mean, one of the reasons that George Adams was put on there, what on the Chinook production, was that we have a stray rate that's just, I mean, it's, it may be, if it's not the highest of any stream, it's close to it. And we had already suggested as part of our approach to try to enhance the recovery of wild fish of doing some production cuts at George Adams for that very purpose. So that the connection on the Chinook piece is in part linked to hatchery reform and looking at meeting our hatchery influence in the natural environment was part of the reason that George Adams was selected. Now, as Joe says, I mean, I think we're spending about 58 million a biennium on our hatchery systems, and they are funded from general fund, local funds, largely PUDs, utilities, mitigation to hydropower in the Columbia River, federal dollars, Mitchell Act, and we have some, and we also have some wildlife fund that are that makes those up. So it's kind of like Joe said, hatcheries is one of our biggest uses of general fund, and so when you're being asked for an 11 million out of a $60 million general fund, I mean, we put eight enforcement officers on our list. I mean, nobody wants to do that. Nobody wants to put these hatcheries on the list. It's that we keep telling folks, hatcheries are a great investment. You create all kinds of jobs and economic activities in a variety of areas through hatchery production and the activities associated with the harvest. But, you know, and we'll continue making those arguments. And the same thing that Commissioner Kehoe was talking about is the economic benefits that are associated with that production and the jobs and stuff that are created in the commercial fishery coming from chum production.
But Commissioner Kehoe.
Yeah, I have some more information for in response to Commissioner Mankin's question about Hood's Port and other funding sources. When we started this public-private partnership with the department, we reached out to the tribes and also to processors, and you know, we got some good support. We had very good discussions. We all came together, and you know, PSVUA was the lead. But you know, along the process, in talking with the Skokomish tribe in particular, they were involved in discussions with the Navy. This is, you know, about 4 or 5 years ago, about mitigation monies for Hood Canal in connection with the Bangor expansion. And Skokomish tribe was entitled or was compensated in terms of money. I mean, they had some ideas about the Skokomish tribe, I think, put up some ideas about land acquisition, and my understanding was the Navy was not too wild about that, but they brought forward this idea of improvements, capital money to be used, given to the department for improvements at Hood's Port, designed to you know, kind of make improvements primarily for chum production. And so right now, and I know Kelly Cunningham is in the room, but I don't want to speak out of turn, there has been discussions with Navy and the department for about $1 million for improvements at Hood's Port and at McKernan Hatchery for chum production. And here we now see, the elimination of chum production at Hood's Port. You know, and so it really sends a, and this is near and dear to my heart, as you might understand and hear by the way I'm speaking, but it just sends this terrible message. And I understand the whole, you know, the budget fiasco, but I mean, the department put forward several hatchery reduction proposals, and Hood's Port is one of the only ones that I see on the list. And that's why, and I expressed that concern to Joe. Hopefully there's no other ulterior motive behind this decision, but amen. taken enough time.
Commissioner Carpenter?
Real quickly, thank you, Madam Chair. A follow-up to Commissioner Mankin's comments. You had asked about the financial commitments and where the monies came from for those hatcheries. I'd also like to dovetail with that to see where the catch sharing is. Who catches those fish to match up with who pays for them?
Commissioner Mankin?
Oh. No, I agree. I just, okay. I'm nodding my head.
Okay.
Okay, I'll move on. Let's see. So again, looking at general fund reductions and what was accepted into the governor's budget from our $11 million proposal, another tough one to see is the enforcement program reduction. Three of the eight positions that we had identified were accepted into the governor's budget, and those would, if this ran through and became real, those would probably be vacant officer positions. Not sure where in the state, but we have some vacancies spread across the state, and we'd have to look at how we remove three of those and provided some sense of coverage too. So,
Deputy Director Storr, I hate this one. I'll go on the record, personal opinion. I hate this one. We did that staffing analysis 5 years ago, probably 6 years ago. Mm-hmm. I keep bringing that forward every year because I don't want people to lose sight of the fact that before we lost a lot of officers, we were trying to carry on business with too few officers. The expert analysis that was done showed that we should have legitimately twice as many officers as we had 5 years ago. So this is horrible stuff here. I want that to go on the record. We need more officers, and just want to say that.
Agree, Madam Chair. I mean, we're very concerned with this. I think this would take us down to about 140 field officers.
Less than at merger in 1994.
Yeah, I don't remember that number, but it's way down. Let's see. The other significant piece of the governor's budget is the compensation collective bargaining agreement piece that the director spoke to. Very happy to see the address of a lack of cost of living increases. You know, the staff haven't received those for 5-6 years. This also addresses some specific job classes like our biologists and some others who are scaled below their counterparts in a lot of other sectors. There are dollars attached to it, and the director spoke to the impact there, and the legislature will have to decide whether these are actually funded or not, but they're in there at the starting gate. So on the capital side, I'll just touch on this briefly. The capital budget we did pretty well in. It's divided into minor works, those projects that are less than $1 million, things like pump replacements, hatchery maintenance, roof repairs, those kinds of activities. And we received about $10.5 million, which was equivalent to this biennium's amount. On the major work side, the large projects, over $1 million, new construction, et cetera, about three times this biennium's amount. And you can see a list of the various facilities. That isn't all inclusive, but it includes some of the big facilities that are in the major works budget. And then finally, I mentioned the book one and book two. I was just focusing primarily on book two, but I have a short blurb in here on what a no new revenue budget or a book one budget might look like. And instead of $2 million of the $11 million in our 15% reduction, in the book one you see $8 million. So a significant impact to hatcheries, enforcement officers, and fisheries management. If it's good news, I'm not sure, but even in the book one, though, you see a list on the bottom of activities the governor chose to fund. So let me move to this recommendation.
Commissioner Carpenter?
Madam Chair, thank you. Joe, on the back page, I just a little brief clarification on number 9, because it's near and dear to my heart that perhaps Phil, maybe he knows or you both know, does that have to do with the tide gate and some other issues that we've been talking about, or do we?
I believe it does, Commissioner Carpenter. I don't have the precise, you know, set of activities in mind, but it's to advance all those things we've been talking about there.
If you could get back to me in a week or two, that'd be ideal. Thank you.
Okay. So let me move to a little bit more detail, and I'm not going to go through with a fine-tooth comb here the numbers, but I think it is interesting, and there's some descriptions for these various performance changes. So I'm looking at this piece with all the fine print. It's sort of fascinating. If you look across the top and you see the 2013 to 2015 expenditure authority, you can see current biennium are annual FTEs. Now, that does not include interagency agreements or some of our seasonal temps. We typically run around 1,600 FTEs, plus or minus 100 or so. You see the 60.8 million that we have in the current biennium for general fund, and 315 of other funds for a total of $376 nearly million dollars. That's our current operating budget. Flip to the second page, and if you go down under total proposed budget, the governor's budget actually increases from $376 million total to $412 million. So, you know, a lot of those maintenance increases, as well as the assumptions around the new fee bill, et cetera, bump up our budget fairly significantly. And look at the general fund, actually, in an era of declining general fund and huge pressures, McCleary, et cetera, our general fund goes from $61 to $69 million. A lot of that, again, associated with maintenance level increases. The way this works, you can look at the particular performance change. For instance, the let's see. Well, you can look at the specific activities identified under performance change and go back and find the text. There's a description if you want to know more in the subsequent pages about, you know, what that includes and what the assumptions were. So this gives you a little more to digest in terms of the specific activities and parts of the agency that would have additions or subtractions to them. So I just wanted you to have that, and if you have questions about any of that, always feel free to give me a call.
I noticed in the first document that you discussed, the budget proposal narrative, at the top you have a header, overall a good budget from the governor considering the current state budget climate, and a positive first step that puts us in a favorable position at the outset, legislative budget development. And you have this repeated at the top. It's a header for each of these pages. As a summary, a reminder, it is a bad budget climate this year again because of the demands of the McCleary decision and the initiative. So we're doing relatively well. Got to keep that in mind, too, as much as we dislike certain elements of the cuts that we're facing.
I mean, it's a matter of perspective and you know, where you are. But when I think back to 2008, the state budget situation was probably as tough in terms of trying to meet a $2 to $3 billion deficit, and it could have been a lot worse. You know, we had as we started 2008, I think we had $25 million general fund reduction. You know, we had 160 staff at risk. I mean, it compared to that point in time, you know, that's what led to that statement. So let me move on. I don't know how I'm doing for time. To this colored piece that deals with our revenue receipts. And this is a report we have generated now for the last 6 or 7 years. What we do is we track revenue receipts month to date. So this report compares the current fiscal year 15 through the fifth month, November, to two things. It compares it to last fiscal year 14 through the same time period, end of November. And it also compares what we received to forecasts that we put forward. We were criticized 6 or 7 years ago for not planning and forecasting accurately about what we anticipated in terms of receipts. And I think we're doing a pretty good job of that. The front page is broken into four boxes. The first is the tan box is a roll-up of all of our revenue sources, fishing, hunting, other Discover Pass, et cetera. The bottom half of that tan box compares our actuals versus our forecast, as I said. The top half compares this fiscal year to date versus last fiscal year to date. And then you see the particulars that go into that tan box. The green includes our hunting licenses, the blue our fishing licenses, and the pink our other licenses. On the right-hand side, you see bar graphs that depict the totals in those areas over the last 7 years. So it's pretty neat. We can see trends. We can see the effect of pink years in the fishing side. We can do a lot with this data. The bottom right corner has those revenue numbers, but the interesting thing we do here is we look at actual individual participation. So that's not licenses sold. Those are actual bodies that come in and purchase those licenses. And the red line across the top shows our individual participation in fishing. The blue line across the sort of in the bottom third is our individual participation in hunting. So for instance, in FY09, we saw 133,000 hunters participate. That has declined to about 125 to date. Fishers, you can see the same, or it's a different trend, and it goes up and down because of pink years primarily. Where pink years are higher, we sell more licenses. We have more individuals buying licenses, and so you can compare every other year is what we typically do, pink years or versus off-pink years. On the second page of this document, we do some analysis. A couple of highlights: total recreational, commercial, and other revenue collections through November, through month five, were about $23.4 million. Just to give you a gauge, last fiscal year, our 12-month revenue was around $52 million. So through month five, we're at 23. That's 0.6%, a little less than 1% revenue, negative revenue growth, or $140,000 lower than the same period in fiscal year 14. So something to keep an eye on. Although fiscal year 14 had the pink impact, right? If you look under fishing revenues, revenues for November was about $32,574 higher than forecasted. Angler participation remained about 8% higher than a typical off-pink salmon year, probably a result of higher than normal supply of salmon, good economy, mild weather conditions. In comparison, angler participation during 09, 11, and 13 off-pink years averaged 288,000 anglers for the same period. So that tells us that about 6,000 brand new anglers entered into the equation, which is good news, and the balance of those 16,000 were returning customers. So we're getting a little more sophisticated in our breakdown and analysis of those numbers. Commissioner Litton, strong salmon run, having a positive impact on licensed products along the Columbia River, like our Columbia River salmon and steelhead endorsement. Year to date, revenue's up 25%, or about $108,000 over forecast. It's great news. Hunting license sales are higher than FY14 through November, with the largest increase in revenue from auction and raffle sales, followed by an increase in small game license sales. And then the Discover Pass, I'm going to talk a little bit more about that, but remain ahead of fiscal year 14 by about 8% or $48,000 for our, that's just our piece, our 8% of the Discover Pass revenues. I won't go through pages 3 and 4, but you can get see a breakdown month to month. The revenue from newly established legislative sources, et cetera. So, again, lots of detail here. I really like this report. It's fun to kind of play with it and look at it and speculate about why things are happening. But if you have questions, please let me know.
Great. Yeah, I like it, too. Commissioner Schmitten?
Thank you, Chair. And Joe, I always enjoy getting this. It's like getting your quarterly stock report. You can track where you are. A comment and a question. Comment is it's pleasing to see the Discovery Pass finally kicking in, meeting expectations. Remember the first year we were down around 200,000? Now we're up, even projected a 7.5% increase, 686,000. That is excellent. Can you, this is my question I always ask, you touched on it, but I can't find it, the Columbia River endorsement, what's the actual total?
Go to page 3, Commissioner Schmitten, and on the bottom of that, in that table on the bottom where it says salmon steelhead.
Yes.
That's what you're looking for.
Columbia River.
And you have the comparison for 14 and 15 of actuals versus our forecast and the biennial totals there.
So it's actually that column, the actual, the 1,508?
Correct, through November.
The department predicted $900,000 annual increase, annual fees way back when this
originally
started. And we've been averaging in around the 1.4, 1.5.
We had such a great year on the Columbia this last year that
keep it going.
That's great.
Keep it going. Keep it. Commissioner Holtzmiller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would just like to echo Raleigh's words on these. I, from someone who is severely affected with ADD, a lot of these other reports just, I get lost in. I love this thing because you can gain a lot of knowledge and it really helps me in my commission when I go home and people start bouncing numbers. You can just start rattling through these things. They're really easy to read and to come up with. And no, keep them coming. I love them.
Well, thanks, Commissioner Holtzmiller. I have to give a lot of credit to Bill Joplin, our licensing division manager. He's the brain behind all of this, and I like it too. So,
yeah, very good. Any other questions?
Okay, I have one final piece, and that's the Discover Pass. And you have two documents. Oh, you have one document. Looks like this. And this is the piece that we're using with the legislature as we talk about Discover Pass. Let me pass around. We're pretty excited about this. This is an example of something that we've accomplished in 2014. So in terms of, you know, we've been working to improve this every year, as Commissioner Schmitten noted, working with the three agencies, a great partnership, very cooperative, strong relationship there. You can imagine parks and, or maybe you can imagine parks and the dependence they have on this revenue source. And they have a commission, too. And, you know, that commission is very focused and intent on keeping parks open. And so this discussion tends a lot of time to be around state parks, and the department has been very good in making sure to remind their commissioners and the public that, hey, there are these other two agencies out there, DNR and ourselves, that gain significant. It's only 8% for each of us, DNR and Fish and Wildlife, but you know, so 16% of the total comes to our two agencies and 84% to theirs. But in the face of all that, we're close, and we've been doing some good things together. Those are highlighted in this Discover Pass piece, where we've partnered to obtain a new print and fulfillment vendor. We were doing a lot of the fulfillment ourselves, and we're saving about 20% on fulfillment costs by doing that. We created this newly designed and more durable annual pass, and I'll talk a little bit more about that in a second. We've tested the market on bulk sales. Can we go out to a Safeway or a Costco and provide bulk sales and have those vendors gain interest, some benefits from it, and sell more of our passes. I mean, we're looking at those kinds of strategies. We have a marketing plan. You may have seen the Subway restaurant advertisements. What's the guy's name that lost all the weight from
eating? Jared.
Darren. Or
Jared.
Jared, okay. Yeah, Jared.
You don't watch enough TV, Joe.
We had Jared out there selling Discover Passes, which was great. So what we're doing with that in 2015 is we're focusing our marketing to promote the redesigned pass. I'll tell you a little bit more about that in a second. We're expanding sales channels and partnerships. I told you about the bulk, bundled, and discount sales to select target markets. And we've got a long-term strategic plan that we're putting together based on actual customer surveys and in-depth analysis that we will probably require some legislative changes, not this session, but in 2016. So very active. We're trying to preempt some of the legislative discussion and concern by showing that, look, we've got our act together. We have 8% sales increase this year. We're looking at other ways to do that. With the new pass specifically, you can see it printed in color on durable synthetic paper. You know, you can't tear it. It doesn't fade. It's distinguishable from the yellow hang tags, which will only be used now as we have traditionally for our vehicle access passes. Enforcement officers going into a parking lot can say that's a different pass than a VAP. Better value. They're less expensive to produce. They look nice. They'll have this expiration date of month and a year on them. And so we're phasing implementation as we speak. New passes are going to be sold initially through the Department of Licensing and the CAMIS system, which is the state parks online sales, starting this next week. New passes will be sold through parks, our wild system, and our retail booklet dealers starting in February. And passes will be sold through the parks automated ticket machines. There are these automated delivery machines at the parks themselves. Same as before, but they'll have the new green hang tag to them. So pretty excited about this. It feels like a real step forward. We're hoping to see an increase on that 8% increase this next year. So wanted you to know that. And this deals with a lot of the concerns we've had about the, you know, we had to put this whole program in place, and I think it was like 6 weeks or something like that originally. Less than that, whispers to me, so we did the best we could, but now's time to get our feet on the ground, expand sales, expand marketing, and move forward. So that is my report.
Great. Thank you. Dr. Anderson, do you have anything else?
I just had a couple numbers I would share with you on the Hood Canal Hatchery, Hoodsport. It was built in 1953, so it's been around a while. Like, it takes about $495,000 a biennium to operate. And revenue comes from three sources. These are biennial numbers: $247,000 from general fund, $70,000 from DJ, Dingle Johnson, excise tax, recreational fishing tackle, and $177,000 from PSRFE, which is Puget Sound Recreational Fishery Enhancement Fund, and it raises about pretty close to 3 million Falls Chinook and 12 million Chum.
Commissioner Mencken?
There's no tribal contribution?
Not according to my records.
And that was for Hoodsport, did you say? Okay. What about the other two hatcheries? Do we know that at this point? McKernan and
yeah. I don't know that I can get to them quickly here. I'll get you all three.
That'd be great.
And there's, especially on Chum, there's lots of shifting around of eggs from McKernan to, I mean, there's, yeah, depending on sometimes Hoodsport comes up short, so they get them from McKernan, and so they're moving them around. But I'll get you a spreadsheet with all three, so you can look at all three.
What was the last fund source you talked about, the one with the acronym?
Puget Sound Recreational Fishery Enhancement Fund. So it's the... When it originated, there was a surcharge put on recreational fishing licenses that were for individuals fishing in Puget Sound. And that was essentially rolled into the recreational fishing license fee total. And we made a projection. We make a projection of what proportion of those licenses sold are for anglers that are fishing in Puget Sound, and then we take a portion of the revenue that comes into the wildlife fund from recreational fishing licenses, and it goes into the Puget Sound Recreational Fishery Enhancement Fund, and then that goes, and we have a Recreational Fishery Enhancement Fund Advisory Committee, and then we work with them and make decisions about where to spend that money in a manner that benefits recreational fisheries.
So that reminds me, Commissioner Kehoe, did you mention at our last meeting, our last discussion about this Hoodsport hatchery, that there would be potential for interest on the part of the commercial fishers to help support costs? Did I remember that incorrectly?
No. I think, the commercial fishing industry realizes the value and would be hard to give up. I will say, though, that we can't, per se, vessel owners can't pay for this loan. There has been some, I guess, fatigue in terms of people. You go and pass the hat every year, and it's like, okay. And then you find, as you go forward, you have people are less willing to come up with a donation or a contribution. I think that's understandable. But I do think, though, with this, and this is why the commercial fishing industry, I know at least my organization is fully committed to this fee, commercial license fee increase legislation, to get us out of this box permanently, and also to restore funding for McKernan. I mean, we did our share, I believe, and we will do what it takes in the legislature or whatever. But I just think it just sends a bad message. And then to answer your question, I do have specific numbers on McKernan. Basically, our contribution to McKernan is $180,000 per year. The department also gets at McKernan. McKernan has the is part of the Wild Steelhead Enhancement Program in Hood Canal, which is done in cooperation with the tribes and NOAA Fisheries and the state. If PSBOA didn't step in, that program would have there would not have been a capability to raise wild steelhead at McKernan, and we do get I think the department gets about $21,000 from the feds, just $21,000, and their view was like, well, that's really all it costs. They didn't appreciate the fact that but for PSVOA, it would have been they would not have had the opportunity to raise wild steelhead. And I appreciate the opportunity to share this with the commissioners and also with the public here. So, anyway.
Okay. Thank Director you. Anderson.
And the numbers I have for the federal contribution into McKernan is $23,901 of biennium. And what I have from the partner, the public-private partnership, is $144,721 for a total of $168,622.
Well, I see the bill. I see the contract. So that's it's. I don't mean to quibble. We can talk later. But yeah,
just a few questions.
Okay. Anything else? All right. We've reached break.